When you make decisions for your company, you always look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing and shipping to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your process to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, books, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart if you sell online. Schedule package pickups through the dashboard and automatically see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are, even on the go. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other business decision makers with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus free postage, and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Creepy. Unsolved. Media. Hey guys, Dylan here, and before we begin tonight's show, I wanted to take a moment to thank all of you. Your listenership means the world to us, and we could not do all of this without you. If you guys have future guest suggestions, or if you want to share stories of your own with us about your encounters with the paranormal, please reach out to us. You can call us and leave a voicemail at 814-320-3432. That is 814-320-3432. And we will get back to you. You can also reach out to us by email. So send us an email at creepyunsolvedmedia@gmail.com. While I have your attention, I would also like to invite you to join our Patreon. You can simply search Creepy Unsolved on patreon.com to find us. In our $5 a month tier, you'll gain access to awesome benefits like ad-free content and early access episodes. Every episode that I produce on Creepy Unsolved will be on there as soon as I am done editing, so you'll be able to listen weeks in advance. Once again, thank you so much for your time, and we greatly appreciate your listenership. Let's begin.
You're listening to Creepy Unsolved.
Hello, what is up, guys? Dylan speaking, and you are listening to Creepy Unsolved. On today's episode, I am joined by the one and only Shane Corson of the Olympic Project. I had such a great time talking to Shane. He is very knowledgeable in the area of Bigfoot field research, and I know you're really going to enjoy hearing all about his personal encounter with the hairy mountain beast and all about the Olympic Project and their discoveries. You're going to hear me throughout a little bit talk about lag. On my end, when we're recording, I did experience some lag with Shane. He had been having power issues the whole day leading up to this recording, but for the most part, I didn't notice any breaks in audio on the playback. Before we begin, I also wanted to mention that Creepy Unsolved is on YouTube. Go over to YouTube, just simply search Creepy Unsolved, and subscribe to us if you haven't already. What you're going to find there is weekly uploads of different content, different podcasts, live streams on Sunday, some YouTube original videos, and stuff like that. Also, while you're listening to the podcast today, please do me a big favor and, send a text message to your friend, send an instant message, give them a phone call, send an email, whatever it may be, and invite them to join the Creepy Unsolved family. Also, while you're listening today, be sure to leave us a 5-star rating and review on whatever platform you're listening from. You know, this will help us grow tremendously. Okay, now that we have all of that out of the way, let's begin.
The topic of discussion tonight is Bigfoot, so I'm very curious to get Shane's thoughts on, you know, the hairy beast that roams the woods. The short time I've been doing this for the past year, I don't have a very in-depth knowledge of Bigfoot. You know, obviously growing up, we've all heard about them. You know, Harry and the Hendersons is a bad example, but I've heard that. You know, I've heard theories about one Bigfoot, about it, you know, possibly the Nephilim being involved, you know, feral people, you know, evolutions of apes and different stuff like this, a paranormal side to Bigfoot. So I'm very curious to get Shane's opinions and discover what he found out with the Olympic Project with their research tonight. So I just want to open the floor up to Shane and let him tell us about his backstory and how he got involved researching Bigfoot and what really sparked his interest. So Shane, if you want to take a moment to introduce yourself and, you know, tell us a little about you, and we'll jump into, you know, your origin story.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks again, guys, for having me on the show. Yeah. So my name is Shane Corson. I am a core member of the Olympic Project. Backstory about myself. I was born and raised in Scotland on a little island off the west coast of Scotland called Islay. Very small little island. And my interest then, as it is still now, was paleontology and dinosaurs. That was kind of my thing. Of course, very heavily invested in and enthused with like things like the Loch Ness Monster growing up. Of course, that's in Loch Ness Monster being in Scotland and Loch Ness. The Yeti, all these different cryptids. My mom actually got me interested in a lot of them with certain books. And so growing up between dinosaurs and cryptozoology and cryptids in Scotland, I just got dove in as much as I could just to get well versed on the topic matter, watching and reading everything I get my hands on. And moved to the States, moved to East County, San Diego in 93 from Scotland. And that's when it really hit me that I was in North America, because even in Scotland, I was very interested in Bigfoot, Sasquatch, you know, with the Patterson-Gimlin film and just everything. Like I said, back then I can get my hands on. When I moved to the States, I realized that I was now in North America, the land of the Sasquatch. And so I, once again, every book I get my hand on, any movie, any documentary, I was so enthused with it. And so from about 93 to 97, that's just kind of what I did. You know, I was 13 years old when I moved here. And 97, when I finally got some wheels, I could start really driving around and got out of high school and stuff. I started going all over California. I went up San Bernardino Mountains, Alpine area, which is famous for the Zubies. That's a really interesting story you guys should look into sometime. The Zubies from Alpine, which was a Bigfoot related subject matter. I started going to Northern California, the Sierras, all the way up to Joshua Tree National Park, which I spent a lot of time in Yosemite Park. I fell in love with Yosemite, just the wildness of it, the remoteness, the trees. And so I you know, from 97 through 2006, before I met my wife, I was going up and down California, looking at investigations, interviewing people. In all those years, 97 throughout whatever, and even before that, I never found anything material-wise of interest. I didn't find any tracks. I didn't find any interesting hair. I had run-ins with all sorts of animals, you name it, bear and everything else, but I never really had an encounter or something I would describe as maybe attributed to Sasquatch. I did talk to a lot of interesting people, a lot of just people that had encounters. So I documented those, and I would go out and do this kind of like ambulance chasing. Oh, there was a report here. So I'd go out this area and drive 5 hours here, 10 hours there, spend a couple of nights here, spend a week over there. But I never really found anything interesting, just interesting people that had interesting encounters. In 2006, I met my wife, and we lived in California and moved up to Oregon in 2008, where my wife is from. She's from Oregon. So I was absolutely enthralled with moving to Oregon, because now I realized that I was in an even better location for Sasquatch activity.
Oh yeah,
in stories, right? So I mean, Oregon, I mean, just there's so many
coming out of there, yeah.
Oh, a ton. And so 2008, we move up here to Oregon. I lived about an hour outside of Portland, a little town called, 20 minutes outside Portland, a town called Beaverton. But I was only an hour away from the coast, an hour away from the mountains. I had woods all around me, so I hit the ground running when I went up there, doing a lot, you know, a lot more investigations, getting out. It's where I found possibly in 2009, maybe my first possible Sasquatch impression or track. It was one of the more interesting ones I ever came across. I don't believe it was a double bear stamp or anything like that. So it got me rejuvenated, and I started doing investigations on the Oregon coast, pardon me, Mount Hood National Forest. And you know, I'm working up in Oregon. 2011 rolls around, and I'm still out there doing stuff. I'm still not having really any encounter. 2011, I was on a remote backpacking trip in the Mount Hood National Forest with two friends, two coworkers that were not interested in Sasquatch. And I was, but definitely this was not a Sasquatch trip. My other hobby is, beside hunting, is I love fishing. So we were going to go remote backpacking up the Mount Hood National Forest. And we had a two-night experience. With the second night, me getting a chance to see a Sasquatch for the first time and having a real encounter, that solidified the existence of Sasquatch for me, and scared the crap out of my two buddies. And so that led me on a path to eventually reaching out to Derek Randles of the Olympic Project and eventually becoming a member and now helping run the organization now with the Olympic Project. And so that's a brief backstory of where I came from and how I got to be involved with the Olympic Project.
No, I am getting a lot of lag on your end, so I hope this is picking up all right. But jumping back into, you know, you said you came from Scotland, so I'm curious, did you grow up with any Bigfoot stories of your own over there, or have you discovered any since?
So over there, no. I mean, they have stories on the mainland Scotland, you know, of the gray man. I don't buy a whole lot into that. I got relatives that hike all around Scotland. Not many forests over there. A lot of hills, a lot of mountains, but a lot of glens. I don't buy into the gray man. I think it's more of a myth. But so nothing really over there to report on. I don't think there's any Sasquatch on the British Isles, personally. I know that some people do. But coming to the States here, yes, since my encounter 2011, never had another direct sighting. I've seen things through some of our expensive FLIR thermal imagery units. I've had a lot of crazy encounters with, you know, trees being pushed over and rocks thrown and a lot of stuff like that that's occurred over the years. Not all the time. Many times you're out in the woods and you're investigating, you're camping out, you're in remote areas, you know, 10, 15 miles out, wherever have you, yeah. A couple miles out. You don't have anything happen. I mean, nothing. Maybe you get a bear encounter or an elk or something of that nature, or a barred owl in the middle of the night that'll wake you up. Most of the time, it's pretty boring research.
Now, you said you had an encounter in 2011?
Yeah, August of 2011. If you like, I can go through that.
Yeah, let's hear about that.
Yeah, and am I lagging on my end at all?
I think it's good right now.
Okay.
Are you getting lag on your end, Sabrina, or is it just my end?
I was initially... when he was kind of telling his backstory, but not right now.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Let's hear about that.
Yeah. So yeah, like I said earlier, two coworkers of mine were avid fishermen. One of the individuals actually from Boston. The other was a native Oregonian. And so we loved fishing. We liked hiking and camping. My buddy from Boston was not really an outdoorsman whatsoever, but he wanted to get more involved. And so we, looked at this map of the Mount Hood National Forest and picked up some really high mountain remote lakes to hike into. There's about six of them in this area. And we were going to make a base camp at one of these lakes and then hop from lake to lake to lake fishing, but always come back to our base camp. So we get to the trailhead. We hike out in this remote area, get to the lake. My buddy and Ian Mitch, we set up our base camp, our tents. And it's still pretty early in the day, so we decided to go and find one of these other lakes that we were going to be fishing and get a little fishing time in there before we come back to camp and build a fire and cook our food. Well, we did our base camp, went off up this ridgeline, and we took the wrong routes and got lost. We ended up way off trail over on this ridgeline. That day we hiked a total, and this was not on purpose, trust me, we hiked a total 17 miles and completely turned around. We were in thick bear country, and bears don't bother me. I run into black bear quite frequently. My buddy Mitch, don't really bother him. We're all armed. I always go.
Oh, yeah, you gotta be, man.
Yeah, and so my buddy Ian, he's a Bostonian. I mean, he's never been around black bear. He's seen black bear marks and stuff, and he's getting a little freaked out. He actually brought a pot and pan. Yeah, for real. So he brought a pot and pan, and he's literally banging it. It got so annoying. He said, "Knock it off, man! Just knock it off." This is, you know, you see that stuff on TV and movies. That, trust me, the black bear are more afraid of you. Yeah. Right. So, he put his pot and pan away. I end up giving him a, which is this will tie in later, which was a mistake on my part. I end up giving him a loner weapon, a 9mm, which ain't going to do a whole lot, but in the right hands it would, but he really had no business having a weapon on him. So long story short, that we get lost up on this ridgeline mountain. We eventually make our way to the lake we were supposed to originally found and fish. Well, by that time it's getting late. It is only a 2-mile walk back to our original camp, though we hiked 17 miles and got lost and turned around. We eventually make it to the lake, and by that time, we figured our big mistake and decided to head back to our base camp, and we would come back the following day and not get lost and fish these lakes. So we hike back to our camp. We get a fire going, big, huge fire. Buddy Ian collects a whole bunch of firewood because he's going to have a huge fire that night because he's afraid of bears in the woods. And we cook food. We talk for a while. We make plans for the following day, and we call the nights around 11:30. Three separate tents right next to this lake. We got a little hill next to us, so we're kind of a little bit lower elevation. We're kind of in like a triangle formation with our tents. I'm in the middle. My buddy Mitch is towards the lake, and my other buddy Ian is kind of towards the hill. And we're all fast asleep. About 1:32 in the morning, 1:32 o'clock in the morning, I hear what sounds like two rocks being clanked together, and it's coming from a distance, and it's getting closer, and it's just... And it's consistent. Oh, wow. It's just consistent. And I've been around all sorts of animals. You name it, elk and deer and you know, antlers. And there's a lot of noises out there that are easily explainable. Well, my buddy Mitch, he wakes up and goes, Shane, are you awake? And I said, yeah. We're whispering from tent to tent. He goes, what do you think that is? And I said, I have no idea. And I was thinking, could it be elk? You know, it's 1:30. It's almost 2 o'clock in the morning. We're listening. And it's getting closer and closer, but it's just consistent. Just consistent.
Like a steady rhythm to it.
Just a steady rhythm. Like, it just doesn't stop. You just get your rocking.
You're there with antlers rattling together and stuff. It's not consistent.
No, and exactly. And it's getting closer and closer to our camp. And so
my initial guess is that it's the Sasquatch, but you know how your buddy's pots and pans together? It's essentially the Sasquatch's method of keeping people away. Like
that's
bears,
great, yeah.
But with rocks.
Yeah,
that's a good theory right there.
Yeah, well, it's kind of interesting you say that. I'll get to that towards the end of this. But yeah, it's getting closer and closer, and then it stops within maybe 30, 40, you know, yards of our camp. And I can hear something moving around now. Now it's marching around, breaking sticks. I think I hear a percussive, like a knock on a tree. Wasn't 100% sure. This time I'm still trying to rationalize this. My buddy Mitch is, you know, what is this thing? And Ian is fast asleep snoring. We listen for a little bit. The thing's moving around. And then we hear that sound again, like the rocks being clanked together. But now it's moving away from our camp. And it moves away and it stops. And that was it that night. And so we go back to sleep. And the following morning, Mitch and I are talking about it, you know, a little bit. Ian thinks we're messing with him. You know, quit pulling my leg. You guys are trying to scare me. You know, but we're out there fishing, so we're like, well, screw it. Let's go hike out to these other lakes. You know, we got a lot of hiking to do. We got a lot of daylight. Let's go fish. And that's what we did. We hiked back out, went fishing, three different lakes, I think, that day, two or three different lakes, came back to camp with our fish. We cooked up a great meal. We talked about the following day, our plans for the following day, because we were going to spend originally 3 to 4 days out in this area. This is our second day, and the second day, right? And so we're making plans. We go out, fish, come back to camp. Same MO. Ian builds this ginormous fire. He's got a bunch of wood piled up. We cook our meal. We talk about our plans for the following day, which would be the third day. And we call it a night about the same time, 11:30. Mm-hmm. And Ian's, he builds up this huge fire. It's going to burn all night. He doesn't want to deal with bears, and he thinks the fire's going to scare everything off. So we go to bed once again, 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning. I hear that noise again. Same thing.
Wow.
And it's coming from a distance, and it's getting closer and closer and closer. Well, it gets really close to our camp, and my buddy Mitch goes, Shane, you awake? And I said, yeah, I'm awake. And he goes, hey, it's back. I'm like, I know. I've been listening to it for a little while. Well, it stops again, and then you hear the movement, boom, crashing around the woods. But this time, it's a lot. It sounds like an elephant. It's like crashing up and around, kind of circling our camp from this hillside. And Mitch is going, I'm hearing something to my left. And I'm thinking, well, I'm hearing something to my right. So I'm thinking possibly there's two of whatever the heck is out there. And it's crashing around, and then it stops. And it's, you got to understand, there, some of these areas in the Mount Hood National Forest, it is so deathly quiet at night sometimes. There's tons of animals out there.
Oh, yeah.
But if you don't have rain or wind, you could hear a pin drop. And it was one of those nights, crystal clear. And we're listening. And I'm thinking, what is going on? That sounded massive. And then wham, wham, wham. Five of the most powerful knocks, power knocks, whatever you want to call them. Something hitting a tree with tremendous force that it echoes. You can feel the vibration in your tent from the ground. My buddy Ian now finally is awake. And he's like, what the hell is that? I said, shut up. So he's in his tent. We're all in our tent still. Those five really powerful knocks came in. And we could feel the vibration, like I said, in our tents. You cannot sleep having heard or felt these. So I'm like, holy crap. Could this be what I'm thinking this may be? And this is unbelievable. I'm not out here doing anything Bigfoot related. Well, that stopped. And once again, my heart's in my chest pounding. And it's silence again. And then I hear something coming from the hill above our tents, hitting the trees, just hitting branches. And it's hitting branches as it's coming down. And then thud, right next to my buddy Mitch's tent. He's next to the lake. There's a little muddy area. And you hear this tremendous thud in the ground. And I knew exactly what it was. And Mitch yelled over it, or not yelled over. He whispered to me, guys, something just threw a rock at us. And I said, I know. And so instantly then I know, okay, there's only two things that throw rocks. People and Sasquatch out here.
Yeah.
So that happened where everybody's freaking out. My, and this thing's moving around, crashing again. My buddy Ian, he's freaking out. He's just losing his mind. I said, where's your gun? Don't pull your gun out. Because I'm thinking he's going to shoot somebody. He has no business having a gun.
And now he's terrified. So
now he's terrified. And I'm thinking he's going to shoot somebody. So I have to get over. I need to get to his tent and get that away from him before he shoots somebody or does something stupid. So I didn't want to get out of my tent. I didn't even want to look outside my tent because there was one point when I was on the ground, I felt paralyzed with fear.
Yeah, you want to move. Yeah.
I didn't want to make a sound because I didn't want this thing to think I'm awake or anything. But I walked myself out of bed. I said, well, if this thing wanted to hurt you, it would have done so by now. So I got to get to Ian. I got to calm him down because he's just losing his mind. Yeah, my buddy Mitch is quiet. I can hear him breathing. So I unzip my tent, and I'm thinking to myself, please don't see anything. So I'm looking around. I'm not seeing anything. So I'm about to unzip the tent further when directly in front of me, 35, 40 yards, I see something moving behind a tree. And as I'm focusing in on it, I could see something swaying back and forth. And what I saw was a hand, an arm, a shoulder, and a head. But it was doing this. It was behind this large Douglas fir tree, swaying back and forth. And it looked like it was looking directly at me, but I couldn't be 100% sure. And I could see fingers. I could see the arm. It just looked dark in color, but massive. And it was just looked massive. And it's just swaying back and forth from behind this tree, and I'm watching it. I don't want to move, and it just takes its arm off, drops its arm, turns around, and goes back up this trail.
It just walks away.
Just walks away. I zip my tent back up, and I sat there. And Ian by this, Ian by this time had seemed like he'd calmed his nerves down. I don't hear him saying anything. I don't see him moving around or fidgeting in his tent. Mitch is quiet. And so basically I just sat there. We all sat there in our tents, not saying a word until daylight. As soon as daylight hit, we collectively, without even talking, grabbed our stuff, packed it up, and got out of there. We hiked out. That, once again, solidified Sasquatch for me. And it took me a good month, 2 months to really get over the not just the awe, but the fear of it. And I decided that you need to go back out there. So I went back out there with my buddy Mitch, and we actually brought a field investigator out there, a good friend of Cliff Berkman's, out there. And we actually had a knocking experience, and he said, yeah, there's something out to this area. And so I started doing in my head, I had questions. Why two nights? Why a two night experience? That's like unheard of. Why did this thing come back through our area twice? You know,
it sounds like he was warning you or trying to get you to leave the first night. Then the second night sounds like an absolute power move. Like he's showing you who's the alpha.
Absolutely. And that's what I eventually came to. Cause at first I thought, well, we are the closest, this is the easiest area to get to the lake to get water. And I thought maybe we're blocking a water source. And oh yeah. True. You know, and I went through my brain and all that, but I started doing research on there and realized that I was in a bit of a mecca for Sasquatch activity. You won't find reports on the BFRO or any other. You're going to find reports on, which I did. It took me about almost a year to find collectively all these different reports from this general vicinity and most of the lakes up there. You find them on AR gun forums. You found them in camping forums, hammock forums, hiking forums. I didn't find any but one report on a Bigfoot site. Everything else was just, hey, did anybody else have this happen to him? Or, hey, I was chased out by this. Or, so I did my homework there. Well, I really started thinking about why this area. Because I thought for sure, I know where they're at. I can prove this. I know
but
where they're at.
But there was like a trend in that area of people reporting the same thing?
Yes, and specifically in the month of August and September, which I thought was very interesting. But then again, a lot more people get out to the woods. They can't.
Yeah.
So that makes sense. But also in those months, you have a lot of huckleberry. Out in those areas, a lot of huckleberry growing in those areas. It gets warmer, so things will come down towards the water. You got a lot of ridges. And so I really started focusing on, okay, why did this thing or things come back two nights in a row? Well, then I went back to what we originally had done. We had gotten lost on this ridgeline that was over this lake, and we got off trail. And we were seeing bear sign, and maybe some of that bear sign wasn't bear sign. Maybe we entered their house, got up on this ridgeline. They're looking at us going, why are there humans up here? Why are they lost? Why are they trekking around? Why are they urinating? Why are they making noise? Why are they bugging us? Humans don't come up on this ridgeline. And so I think we stirred up either a couple of Sasquatch or a unit or one individual. I don't know. Definitely one. And I think he came off that ridge two nights in a row to get us the heck out of there, knowing that we, you know, basically just tracked us back to our camp. And I think that's the simplest, you know, answer. And you got someone up there banging a pot
banging
around.
Banging pots and pans. Yep.
Banging
it's
pots
the
and
classic.
Pans.
Get rid of the bears. Get rid of the people. Just scare them on off. He's just literally running around like, go on, get.
Exactly.
Shooing y'all away.
Yeah. I mean, so that's the simplest answer. So for months, I thought I could prove this thing existed. Well, for months, I was out there and I never had anything else happen. I did find another really good impression on the other side of the lake where something could easily watch my camp. But other than that, I didn't have nothing happen for months. And so I got a little frustrated. I started to come up with excuses like, well, I need more, you know, more equipment and this and that. But then I came to the conclusion that Sasquatch is not always in that area. And you're not this isn't a one man band sort of thing. You need help. And so that's when I started reaching out. I reached out to Cliff Berrickman. He's now a good friend of mine. And Derek Randall's of Lunar Project. I started collaborating with, you know, specifically Derek. And went on a couple of expeditions with him. And then he formally, knowing my background and the avid outdoorsman I am and some of the skills I could bring to the Element Project, he invited me to be a member. And so that's how I got involved in the tail end of 2012 with the Olympic Project. And we've just, you know, been going at it ever since. And we've been working on a lot of really good things. Probably the most exciting thing I think collectively as a group we've been working on is a nesting area up in the Olympics here in Washington And to me, it's one of the most profound discoveries to date on the Sasquatch, in the Sasquatch phenomenon, if indeed this is Sasquatch related.
Yeah. Now, before we go any further, can you like explain what the Olympic Project is?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Olympic Project is basically a fairly decent sized group of like-minded individuals from all walks of life in academia. We have wildlife biologists, we have archaeologists, we have primatologists, we have guides, we have hunters, we have your outdoorsmen and women. So collectively, we're very like-minded in our pursuits. The vast majority of the Olympic Project membership have either had a sighting or encounter. So there, we're already past the point of do they exist? We're into like why and how and all that. We do have a few individuals that are more on the skeptical side, but they're very interested because they know there's something going on here. They've just to date not had anything happen to them. But our main goal as an organization is not to prove the existence of Sasquatch. We already know it's out there. Our main goal is just to collect data. We collect data. That is our favorite thing to do. We have loads and loads and loads of data. We work with an individual by the name of Squatchermetrics. He's a analyst, like a soccer analyst by trade. He actually lives in London, but he comes over here frequently. He's on Facebook and Instagram. A lot of people from different organizations reach out to Squatchermetrics for Sasquatch data. He can give you anything you want. You ask, okay, what? Where's the? You know, I'm in Montana. What elevation should I be at? Where's, he'll give you all sorts of data. So that's what we do. We collect data. We collect, sighting reports. We collect, we're not much for ambulance chasing anymore. We have about three different areas in Washington state that we focus in on. One's in southwestern Washington. One's in two other spots in the Olympics where we own a substantial bit of property.
A lot of activity at there, I'm assuming.
Yes, yes. And sometimes no. The key is back in the day, a lot of us used to do, I know Derek Randall's, he's been at this since 1980s. He used to do a lot of, and he used to be with the BFRO and all that, but he used to do a lot of ambulance chasing. Oh, here's a report in Idaho. Boom. 10, 12 hour drive. He drives and goes. Here's a report in Western Washington. Boom. Gone. You're
chasing the tail end of it at that point then.
Yeah, exactly. You might find an impression. You might, but that sucker's already gone. So we've really focused in on for many years now on key areas, getting to know everything about that area, getting to know the wildlife, the fauna, the plants, the weather, if there's no activity, why? If there is activity, why? What's the moon phase? What's what time of year? What month? So we're just in these areas collecting as much data on not just Sasquatch, but everything in that area. Like I said, the plant life, the food sources, the different seasonal things that transpire, like salmon runs in these areas. What are the coyotes doing? What are the bears doing? What are the elk doing? The deer, the cougar, all these animals. We're painting a picture here and trying to collect as many patterns of predictability. That's huge.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you.
Patterns of predictability. That's what we're all about, is we're trying to figure out the why and the how and the when and all that when it comes to Sasquatch. And so that's what we're about. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause it's like, you don't want to filter out too much stuff and you kind of want to get to know what's normal as much as possible. So, and if something is abnormal, you can be like, I wonder why. And then you go research that. No, that makes a ton of sense. I live in like Southern Idaho and I kind of just want to know where to not go camping.
You're in Southern Idaho?
Yeah, I'm in Mountain Home.
Oh, my brother lives in Horseshoe Bend.
Okay.
Yeah, he's lived there for several years now, so I'm very familiar with that area. We're not to go camping, huh? That's funny.
So you're almost essentially like predicting a Sasquatch sighting.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office.
More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky?
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Is that what you're trying to do?
Yes, and yes, I mean, partly. We're trying to decide, we're trying to figure out when and where they will be. Like in the Olympics, we can tell you roughly what elevation at certain times of year you have a chance of having a sighting or an encounter. And so that's one of the things. You know, also, you know, why that area? Well, the food sources, what could be growing that time of year? And then we also look at what people are doing in some of these areas. If there are any people in these areas, some of these areas are very, very remote. And then some not so much. You know, you got trails in some of these areas. And so we're also trying to see what the people are doing and how the Sasquatch and other known animal react to the people in these areas. So we're basically just trying to collect as much data on the Sasquatch phenomenon as humanly possible to so that if in that day, you know, the species is verified to exist, we'll already have a plethora of stuff available for academia and science. We are right now working with.
Now you mentioned Sasquatch Nest earlier.
Well,
what's that all about?
I can't definitively say that they are Sasquatch nests, but I'll give you the backstory on this because it's today probably the most exciting thing, bar none, that I've ever worked on. But in 2016, I got a call from Derek Reindels of the Inland Project saying that a timber cruiser, a timber surveyor, a guy out marking an area that was going to be timbered in a remote area behind a locked gate, 2.5 miles behind a locked gate and way off trail, came across some ground nests. And in his 27 plus years of doing this stuff, he's bumped into every animal out there. He's seen it all. In his 27 plus years, he'd never seen anything like these giant ground nests. And they're very reminiscent of like a giant bird's nest. They're not a structure. They're a ground nest. And so Derek had done work for this guy. Derek's a landscaper by trade. And 10 years prior, Derek had done some work for this guy. Derek's been on TV shows. You know, he's done it all. And he's, you know, everybody knows him as a Bigfoot guy. So this timber surveyor got a hold of Derek and said, "Hey, I came across these really odd ground nests. Would like you to take a look." And because Derek's also a guide, and he's lived in Washington for pretty much his whole life. And he's an avid off-trail hiker like most of us. He, you know, so this guy, this timber surveyor knew that and said, "Hey, can you come look at this?" So Derek grabbed his buddy James, and about a couple days later, along with the timber surveyor, 2DNR, Department of Natural Resources, and the owner of this property, they all hiked out to this area. And all of these guys, not one of them, in all their years of you know different occupations and jobs, had ever seen anything like these ground nests. They actually found that day, they found 3 or 4 of these large ground nests. I mean, some of them are 3 feet across, and so others are 8 to 9 feet across, oval-shaped, more oval-shaped than round, made out of huckleberry, all out of huckleberry, kind of weaved around each other over a foot in depth. And so after they got talking about it, this group and these individuals, they gave the owner of this property actually said, "Hey, I'll tell you what, this is really interesting. I'm really interested in this. You know, obviously we can't say Sasquatch or anything like that, but you know, we don't need to timber this area anytime soon. So we'll lay off timbering this area for a good 4 or 5 years. Here's a key to this gate." And they don't just hand those keys out to anybody.
Oh yeah, I bet.
So they gave us a key. And so we actively started researching that area. And what you have basically is there are a lot of ravines and hills in this area, but you have a ridgeline with plateaus or fingers coming off this ridgeline. And on these fingers or plateaus, you have different nests, and it could be 200 or 300 yards apart from finger to finger. But we to date have found 23 nests spread out in this area. We found a couple of nests built into bushes in the huckleberry off the ground that looked like practice nests that, you know, Derek had done some research on this. Not only were the ground nests very, very, very similar to gorilla nests in construction and manner, but the bush nests wouldn't hold any weight, but they're very reminiscent of what mother gorillas will teach their little ones to do, practice nests. They're identical. And there was only 2 of those found, not together on different fingers, but these nests, we brought in Dr. Jeff Meldrum out there a few times. He's a collaborator with us, Cliff Bergman, and we brought in zoologists, we brought in primatologists out in this area. zoologist from a different part of the country here, and we found multiple samples of unidentifiable hair that seems to match other possible Sasquatch hair, and definitely primate hair. Dr. Meldrum will tell you that. Cindy Dosen of Hominae Enigma, who's a hair analyst out of British Columbia, will tell you that it's primate hair. And she actually has a huge, she has a good collection of suspect and possible Sasquatch hair. And one of the key elements of this hair is that not only underneath a microscope does it have red pigmentation, but it lacks a medulla, which if you think of a pencil, that would be the lead in the pencil. So it lacks a medulla. This isn't bear hair. This isn't elk hair. This is not human hair. It's coarse. It's untinted on, you know, nothing's been done to it. It's primate hair. So we found that. We've also found multiple impressions in this area. This area does have an interesting history of reports. We also have been doing long-term audio recording in this area where we've gone, you know, we record anywhere from 20 to 30 nights in one go with multiple units. And we've recorded very, very primate-like recordings, very kind of human-like recordings, percussives, a lot of really cool stuff on our audio recordings. So from 2016 through 2020, we had found, you know, these 23 or 22 nests at that time. We actually found most of those nests by the end of 2017. But from then on, we wanted to go look in different areas and find more nests if there was nests to be found. But we weren't finding anything, and nothing was coming back to the older nest. We kind of monitored them. And even though we were getting recordings and finding an occasional impression out there, we weren't finding new nests. And we kind of came up to the idea that maybe these are like if it is Sasquatch related, a birthing scenario that they don't make nests all the time. Maybe they come through here every 3, 4, or 5 years. I mean, maybe they're like an orangutan. They give birth every 6 to 8 years. And so these nests will be constructed just for a birthing or nursery scenario. That was a hypothesis. Still running with that.
But they don't lay eggs.
I hope not, because I haven't found any giant eggs yet. You never know.
And I know it's silly, but I mean, maybe some of our listeners aren't familiar with the Sasquatch. Like, when I hear nest, I'm thinking of there's a big old egg in there somewhere. And I just really hope that that's not, if it's not the case, I'm glad. And if it is, I want to see one.
Yeah,
I was honestly thinking like Thunderbird when you started talking about nest, but with them being like multiple with 22, 23 nests, are you under the assumption that these are like a pack animal?
Possibly, you know, because these nests are also like on the fingers. They're actually strategically placed. It's a very steep decline into a seasonal salmon creek. That time of year that they were discovered, the salmon that come up that creek, you could walk across them. It's like a National Geographic photo where you just see the salmon. And then they had the huckleberry, which actually has medicinal purposes. Doctors used to give women a concoction of sugar and leaf to regain their strength. We found two rocks at what we called a point nest. And like I said, we have a former Top Gun pilot in our group who, when he saw the layout of the nest, the very V, kind of a V formation, with the little ones, the little smaller nest kind of in the middle, almost protection. He said, this is very military-like. And you had these two rocks at the point nest, which leads right down to that steep ravine, quick escape. They had score marks on them. Something at one time had smacked those rocks together. They're about softball size. The only rocks in this area that were above ground. These areas are very, you walk into them and you see complete devastation. All the huckleberry boughs from a foot off the ground to 9 feet off the ground are snapped. And that's what formulated these nests. That's what made these nests. When we brought Dr. Meldrum out there to get soil samples for eDNA study and other things, we deconstructed our nest, one nest for the first time. And what he had noticed was that some of the huckleberry boughs had been pushed into the ground. And then the huckleberry wrapped around it, almost like a frame. So this took something with a opposable thumb to snap the stuff because there's no teeth marks or bite marks. The huckleberry boughs were pushed in the ground. So this took something with intelligence and with an opposable thumb. Period. Yeah. So that rules out just about, you know, people can argue it's bear. No, these are nests, like you said. And if you think of a giant bird's nest, but with the actual construction, but massive and over a foot in depth, someone's huckleberry is anywhere from, you know, 1/4 inch to 2 inches in diameter. Most individuals cannot snap this. So this takes something with also extreme amount of strength to break something you know, 9 feet off the ground, and then drag it in some cases 25 feet away to construct a nest, a ground nest. So it just took a lot of intelligence here. I do think that this was a family unit. To get back to your original question, I do believe this was possibly a family unit. If indeed it's Sasquatch, it was a family unit moving. I don't know if they're always in family units. I have no idea. I assume that maybe they are. But who knows? It just could have been a one-time thing. There have been other nests found throughout history because I did my homework on this. You know, this wasn't like a one-time affair. The only thing that separates this particular find is the amount of nests found and that they're actually studied. And there have been nests found in California, Alaska, Canada, Oregon, Washington, almost always by timber surveyors or somebody in a timber company, because these aren't areas you hike into. These aren't areas you hunt, you walk, you camp. They're remote. They're thick. They're hard to get to. You can't see a couple of feet in front of you. Timber surveyors have a job to do. So they're going to be in these remote areas marking timber. Yeah. 1967. You guys are probably familiar, obviously, with the Patterson-Gimlin film, right?
October. I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, well, so I do believe that is a real Sasquatch, a female Sasquatch. But I know Bob Gimlin very well, and he's a very honest man. But in 1967, on October 20th, you had Roger and Bob capture what I believe is a Sasquatch on camera, on film. Well, that same year, there was a timber surveyor out there by the name of Lyle Lafferty, who was marking an area or doing something up in this area above Bluff Creek, where the film was filmed. His name's Lyle Lafferty, and he was above an area called Scorpion Creek, which feeds into Bluff Creek, where Patty was filmed, and he came across a giant ground nest. A giant ground nest that sounds exactly, in 1967, the same year. And within months, I think. And he came across large impressions. Well, if you look at Patty, and this kind of gets back to my whole hypothesis or idea that this is a birthing scenario or something of that nature. If you look at Patty, to me, she looks like she either had given birth or was about to give birth. You know, obviously she had very large breasts. I mean, you can tell it's a female. But maybe that nest, which was a stone's throw away, was, you know, maybe there were other nests out there. Who knows? But there was another nest found out there. And I thought with the Sasquatch and the nest, I don't think that's coincidental. I think that they both go together, just like what I think we're dealing with now with these nests. In 2020, I'll move forward here a little bit. You know, my buddy Todd and I were out looking. Once again, we're out all the time. We're out multiple days a week, sometimes longer. We were looking in a dim ravine, not too far away from the original nest area. And we built our camp on the end of this logging road, and we're going to hike into this ravine that evening just to, before we finish setting up camp, we were just going to get a brief view of this area. We're going to research the next day and see what we come across. Well, that night we walked in on something actually constructing one of these nests. It approached us. We drew our weapons. At first, we thought it was a large bear. The thing retreated, went back down in the ravine and circled up behind us. It's 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Ooh. 4 o'clock in the afternoon, we're at a low elevation or lower vantage point. So we go back up the hill to where this thing possibly was. Mm-hmm. We could hear it moving and it moves off, and we didn't hear it anymore. So we decided to go back to where we originally had heard it. And as we go back down into this area, and it was by sheer luck we walked in on this thing, because we'd walk maybe 20, 30 yards either direction that night. We may have found it the following day, but that night we would not have come across it. But we walked down in there, and sure enough, I start seeing all these huckleberry breaks. And they were fresh. I could tell. And instantly I thought, we're going to find a nest here. And so it's getting dark. We had a hike out. We decided we weren't going to touch anything. We were going to come back there tomorrow with we'll call our buddy Derek Randall's up, and he'll come out. So we go back to our camp. That night we had a couple of things happen around our camp. Nothing major, maybe something throwing some stuff in our camp. We wake up the next morning after having called Derek. Derek takes a long drive out to meet us. We hike out to this area. We hike into where we heard this thing, and sure enough, there was a tremendous amount of huckleberry that had been collected and was starting to be formulated into a nest. Oh, and wow. We always wanted to find another nest, but I never thought we'd find one in the making in the culprit. So
that's wild.
We didn't want to touch anything again. I'm not a scientist, so I have collected many samples, but we decided, let's do this right. We're talking, this is the end of February 2020. Let's get a hold of Dr. Meldrum. We'll fly him out. We'll get a hold of some other academic individuals. We'll have them do all the collection, you know, so we don't have anything to do with it. We found it. We're not going to contaminate it.
That's smart.
What happened around that time? Pandemic. So in February is a bad month for weather up here. So we had gotten hold of Meldrum, but the pandemic was, we didn't know what to expect. So we decided, you know what, Meldrum, we're going to cancel your flight. You're not coming out. Hopefully this will pass. We just don't want to take any chances. We don't know what we're dealing with. Well, you know, week went by and we decided with the weather changing, we just need to get in there and start investigating this area and collecting samples. And so we get a hold of, we have done some more hiking out in this area. A buddy of mine and fellow Project Olympic manager, member, James Millen, wanted to find out where this thing had circled around us and went up. Well, he found this large hand impression, two hand impressions going up the hill.
Oh, wow.
And it was profound. And once we go back into the initial area where this nest was being built, we start finding impressions on the ground. We're finding hair. I get a hold of Cliff Berrickman because he's a good friend of ours and he's got access to a lot of casting material. So we have Cliff come out. Cliff's going to help us cast a lot of these impressions. And originally, we didn't want to cast a hand impression. We just wanted to take soil from that and hopefully get some environmental DNA done on the skin cells. But the weather was changing. We were going to lose the stuff.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited
by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details. Gave Cliff to go ahead. Let's just cast everything. So Cliff went and casted the hand impressions. We found between Todd Hale, myself, and Cliff, we found 14-inch tracks in this area. Another half hand impression. Lots of hair. We collected all of this huckleberry. I brought in about 8 bags, 30-gallon paper sacks to collect all the huckleberry that had been collected. So we came away with multiple bags of huckleberry with hair on it that had been stripped. We came away with casts, hand impressions, foot impressions, and we started doing long-term audio in this area. Nothing had been back to that area. And I've told people this before. Looking back on it, it's kind of a catch-22. I kind of wish we had not walked in on this thing making a nest because it took a lot of time to collect that material, And now that we disrupted it and it was found, it wasn't going to come back there. It was kind of an argument in the group. Some people thought that it would come back. And I said, there's no way. It's not coming back. It may come back to visit, but it's not going to finish what it started, which it never did. So I felt bad. I felt like, this is a birthing scenario, something of that nature. And we finally, after 4 or 5 years, we came across a brand new nest in the making, Timber Ravine, same area. Now what's it going to do? I'm going to have to go move somewhere else and build a whole new nest. So I kind of feel guilty about that. But for science, I'm glad we got the hand impressions. We got some hair. We got all this other stuff. And this encounter where this thing approached us, and it did not act like a black bear. Black bears will almost 10 times out of 10 will book and run the other way.
Oh, thing, I know it.
This thing came at us and then retreated and then circled up around us, assuming that it was just the one. I never got my eyes on it. I wanted to. But we started placing long-term audio in this unit area. And within days, we started getting really heavy bipedal movement, percussive sounds, yells. So what we're dealing with right now is that we've got all this, just such a unique situation where we have not just audio recordings, not just hand and feet impressions, not just hair, not just huckleberry, not just these nests, but you add that all together and it paints a picture and it really does scream Sasquatch to me. I don't know what else.
Yeah, I don't know what else you'd explain it as.
These are nests. They're giant nests constructed and they take a long time. Derek Randalls and I, yes, we deconstructed the nest, but I learned more from actually reconstructing the nest. We actually just built our own nest to see how long it would take. Between two of us, it took us over 45 minutes to build a large, 8-foot nest out of huckleberry, trying to mimic as close as we could as to what we discovered.
Mm-hmm.
And collecting stuff from different heights and, trying to break some of this huckleberry that was very, I'm a strong guy. Derek Randalls is definitely a strong guy. some of the stuff we couldn't break. And we had to transport it. That was the thing that really blew my mind, was that sometimes we'd have to go 25 feet away to grab another, you know, after we collect everything around us, we had to keep going further and further out. And then once we formulated that nest, we were pretty impressed with it. And we watched it decay over 3 months. Once it had decayed down and browned up and all that, we realized that we still hadn't collected, even though it looked right in the beginning, it wasn't. We needed actually had to collect more huckleberry to make even this thing even remotely close to what was discovered. So I'm pretty confident these are possibly Sasquatch nests. You know, I get some grief from a lot of these skeptics. They're not even skeptics, they're skeptics. But this is not bear. This is not bird. No one's hoaxing us. This is way off trail. This is not human behavior. Everything to me screams that, given the hair, the hand impressions, the feet impressions, this is quite possibly Sasquatch. And the question for me now is, if it is, then why are these birthing scenarios? Do Sasquatch make nests all the time? I don't think so. They're very rarely found, but they are found, even though in the remote areas, I would expect more of these to be found. And these nests were definitely stayed in for more than a day. This wasn't like what a gorilla would do, make a nest and then move on. These were stayed in for a couple of days, if not a week or more. I can't say how long, but they're definitely made, without a doubt, I think, in the months of February and March, based on what we've come across.
Now, have you tried to put any trail cams out here on these nests or anything like that?
We did. We started out with that, but nothing really had been back in this area. There was no wildlife going in and out of these nesting areas, and there's black bear out there, you got cougar, you got elk, you got deer, you got all these the usual suspects. Nothing was going on these fingers. I mean, it was like whatever made these nests vacated and nothing was coming back. It took a good, at least 6 months for us to start getting any wildlife in this area on these little fingers. We do utilize game cameras. The problem with game cameras is they really do stick out like a sore thumb. I do think they give off, some people say Sasquatch can see the IR or can see or hear, the noise or, I don't put my cameras on trees. I don't put them on straps. I put them in stumps. I try to conceal and hide them the best I can.
It's a good tactic, yeah.
I think it's paid off. I think we got some interesting results on some of our game cameras that are not public because it's ambiguous, sure. But what I like to do is I don't put my game cameras in the nesting area because, first of all, you're going to get 1,000 shots of debris, trees, wind blowing and all that. Stick out. They stick out like a sore thumb. Whether Sasquatch can hear them, see them, smell them, who knows? But I do know that there's a lot of creeks and rivers in this area and a lot of encounters that happen, not just in this area, but historically and to date, where someone's either fishing a river or hiking a river and they come across a Sasquatch or the Sasquatch is in the water and approaches the human. But it's almost like every time that happens, the parties are surprised. The Sasquatch goes, oh, there's a human, or the human goes, oh, there's a Sasquatch. Well, why is that? Well, I think it's because you have a lot of noise coming off these creeks, so you're not going to hear much. There's different smells coming off these creeks and rivers. So I like to put my cameras next to rivers and creeks and stumps to conceal. Everything's got to come to water at some point, whether crossing it or drinking it. Your best chance, I think, of getting something on a camera is next to a creek or a river where it conceals the sound and the smell. And the only other area I've thought, I got something years ago bipedally walking past my travel trailer when I was out in an area that two loggers had seen a Sasquatch family unit. So I camped out in this area on purpose, and I put my game camera in the back of my travel trailer, and I got something at 2 a.m. bipedally walking across in the month of February, 2 a.m. and relatively speaking, a few air miles from the nesting area. So camera placement, yes, we do utilize it, but just not in the nesting area, but in the surrounding areas.
I just want to say, I think it's pretty tactful to put it by these creeks because you're not as vigilant, I guess, because you're thinking of water or food when you're approaching these creeks. So maybe that's why it's more susceptible to picking up, different images of Sasquatch or whatever it might be.
Yeah, absolutely. Like everybody argues that there's thousands of game cameras out there, but relatively speaking, if there's not that many Sasquatch and there's all, you might have thousands of game cameras out there, but you're not it's very arrogant to say that you're going to have a game camera in the right spot for a Sasquatch to move by when they're, I think they're rare to begin with. And also, most people that place trail cameras out there, they're putting them on trees, they're putting them on game trails to for their quarry, which is usually deer and stuff like that.
Mm.
I don't think Sasquatch typically uses a whole lot of game trails. A lot of the impressions and stuff we found are in the middle of the bush. This huckleberry out in this area, it's over 9 feet tall. It is thick. I think Sasquatch moves around that stuff, and you'll define an impression is special all by itself. But you can't place game cameras in those areas because you just got bushes. What are you gonna see? You might get something brushed by it. So it's very, very hard.
Thick and dense that you're not gonna pick up.
Yeah, and
clear image or whatever.
People, general hunters and stuff, they don't put cameras in that area. It doesn't make any sense. They're gonna put them on game trails where animals like deer are gonna come across. So there's a lot of game cameras out there. But good luck. You're looking for a moving needle in a haystack. Okay, so it's just not gonna happen. So game cameras can be, and I have seen some very compelling photos and video over the year from game cameras that are just not public. A lot of people just don't want that stuff out there. But I've seen some very, I mean, just this past year, I saw probably the most incredible Sasquatch photo I've ever seen from an individual that doesn't want it out there. He just doesn't care, and he's got his reasons for that. But it does happen.
Now, what kind of image is this? Is this like a clear shot of the face, or what are we talking about?
Face, body, shoulder, hand, basically watching a group of individuals on a lake. It was a photo taken of somebody was fooling around with their camera, was taking photos of people on the lake, and something was watching them from across the lake. There's more detail on this, but I can't divulge that only because this individual, he wants to use this photo to see, basically, as he told me, he wants to use this photo to, if someone tells him they had a Sasquatch sighting, he wants to use this photo to see if it matches up with their description. Because then he said, as he told me, he can call bull on them if it doesn't match with this photo. So he doesn't want it out there. He doesn't want it public. He shared it with me in privacy. I hope to look at it again because it was phenomenal. And there was a lot more detail there, stuff that just blew my mind. So, In an area that I would expect Sasquatch to be. So cameras and stuff like that can work. It just, it's very difficult.
Now, do you have an idea of, the population of Sasquatch or Bigfoot, how massive that is?
You know, there's about 30,000 some odd black bear in Washington State.
Hmm.
I really don't like to guess numbers. I mean, there's individuals. Dr. Meldrum's got a really good figure. In Washington State, I don't know. There's just not that as many as people think. In the Olympics, I hate to throw numbers out there, but there could be 100 of them there, maybe less. And I think they do quite well in small numbers. If you look at like Cross River gorillas or some orangutan groups, they 500 of them, and they do just fine. They don't have inbreeding and they do quite well. But I really don't know. I just know it's a lot smaller than 30,000. We're probably talking in the thousands, maybe. And just say Washington State, maybe 1,000. I honestly don't know. I leave that up to smarter minds. I just don't think there's that many Sasquatch out there. I don't think there needs to be. I think they do quite well on their own, but definitely smaller in number. Then I think a lot of people would, maybe they wouldn't think. Maybe they do think they're small in number.
I lost you a little bit there. But sorry.
I just don't think there's that many Sasquatch out there. I don't think there needs to be. And I think that's why encounters, are relatively rare. I think they're just rare because they're just small numbers of Sasquatch. They're just not, I definitely believe you have them in Northern California. You have them in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Montana, definitely in British Columbia and Canada, and in some other states, Ohio, most likely. I think Sasquatch can do quite well under the radar in a lot of these areas. I think they do need certain things to survive, the obvious things, but small number for sure.
Now, before we close out tonight, I wanted to ask you just kind of what I started off the conversation with tonight. What do you think, Bigfoot or Sasquatch actually is? Is this like blood and flesh, or is this some people compare it to being a paranormal entity, or they refer to it as like a ancestor, the Nephilim, or what kind of idea do you have about Sasquatch?
Like I tell people, first of all, 100% is flesh and blood, because if it walks like a duck, talks like a duck, acts like a duck, it's a duck. And that's what Sasquatch, you know, does. It's reported to eat roadkill. It's reported to raid trash cans. It's reported to throw rocks. It lives in the woods. It's hairy. It survives on all the natural resources out there. To me, there's nothing. I've never had one paranormal experience in all my years. None of the Unlimited Project members, and we spend an ungodly amount of time in the woods, not just in Washington, but I spent many, many years in Oregon. I've had some stuff that I thought was possibly unexplainable at the time. Maybe someone would call it paranormal, but later on I explained it rather easily once I'd actually follow through with my homework and investigate it. I didn't leave it as is. I had to figure out what exactly I'm looking at, experiencing. And I proven them every single time that it was a natural phenomenon or something natural. Now, Sasquatch, I do believe it's a sort of non-human primate, but I don't put it in the same. You know, I mentioned gorillas a lot tonight and orangutans. First of all, people don't give grade apes and stuff enough credit. They are super intelligent. But I don't put Sasquatch even in that category. I do believe it's something on that tree, but much smarter, obviously. Absolutely apex in its environment. There's nothing else like it out there. I mean, it's not going to go build a fire or anything like that, but it doesn't need to. It's got the wood savviness. It knows how to survive. And it's a natural part of its environment. It always has been. And like I said, something that that leaves vocals, leaves hair, leaves scat, does all that. It's nothing paranormal. It's just it's an absolutely amazing creature, no matter what it is. Definitely, without a doubt, flesh and blood.
Definitely. And like your stories tonight are very compelling. And I would believe that it is flesh and blood too, from what you've told me and the facts you shared about it. You know, I really enjoyed this conversation tonight. I'd really like to do this another time. If I ever make it out to the West Coast, we should meet up, and I'd love to go on a field research with you and see what you guys are getting into out there.
Absolutely, Dylan. Anytime you're out this way, get a hold of me, or if you're planning a trip, get a hold of me and we'll make it happen. It's been a pleasure being on the show and talking with you guys.
Yep. Thank you, man.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Creepy Unsolved. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to hear more like it, please leave us a rating and review on whatever platform you're listening from. This will help our podcast grow. Also, be sure to subscribe, follow, and share the podcast. If you have an interesting story or would like to be a guest on a future episode of Creepy Unsolved, please reach out to us through Instagram or Facebook at Creepy Unsolved, or send us an email at creepyunsolvedmedia@gmail.com. We look forward to hearing from you soon.